and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into the subject of our national security in terms of whether we are getting our money's worth from our intelligence community after we have thrown billions at them following their clear failure to prevent the 9/11 attacks. We will replay a recent interview I did with James Bamford on August the 4th to get a critical assessment of why the CIA and the NSA missed 9/11, even though they had a lot of information at the time which was not shared or acted upon. An investigative journalist specializing in national security issues, James Bamford is the author of the bestsellers Body of Secrets, The Puzzle Palace, and The Shadow Factory, Inside the Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to Spying on America. And we will discuss his article at Foreign Policy, Missed Calls, Is the NSA Lying About Its Failure to Prevent 9/11? Then we'll examine the other dominant component of national security, our military hardware, and the military-industrial complex that makes it, along with the software that supports it, in particular the intellectual underpinning of our military and security policies that are often dictated by technological capability rather than strategic thinking. One of America's premier military experts, William Arkin, who co-authored the landmark Top Secret America investigation and the national bestseller of the same name, joins us to discuss his latest book, Unmanned, Drones, Data, and the Illusion of Perfect Warfare, and how our security is undermined by our impulse to gather too much data, and that by using drones to avoid putting our troops in danger, we put the rest of us in more danger. We recently spoke on July the 30th. And joining us now is James Bamford, an investigative journalist specializing in national security issues. He was the Washington investigative reporter for ABC's World News Tonight and is the author of the best-selling books Body of Secrets, The Puzzle Palace, and The Shadow Factory, Inside the Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to Spying on America. He currently writes for Wired magazine and is also a columnist for Foreign Policy magazine, where he has an article, Missed Calls, Is the NSA Lying About Its Failure to Prevent 9/11. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Bamford.
Well, thanks, Ian. I appreciate it.
And your article's extraordinary, Jim, and it starts out with this plot that was uncovered by U.S. intelligence that an al-Qaeda affiliate in London had urged its supporters to send Clinton back in a coffin, referring to Bill Clinton's visit to Bangladesh, where they were going to fire a shoulder-launched missile to shoot down the president's chopper. Now, that obviously, Clinton canceled that particular leg of his trip on the advice of intelligence. But what's so extraordinary is that same day, one of the hijackers of 9/11 down in San Diego called this number in Sana'a, Yemen, that the NSA had on the top of its watch list, the Yemeni number 96712000578, apparently was at the pinnacle of their target list. But somehow they later said that they really didn't know who was making these calls. So I guess what I find extraordinary is not only is that extremely unlikely and been refuted, as you have in your article, by several people, James Bamford, what I find extraordinary is that Michael Hayden, the head of the NSA at the time, who later became the head of the CIA, he used that so-called gap in the intelligence as a way to justify the metadata program that later Snowden revealed. So I've never known how people can profit from their mistakes in this extraordinary way.
Well, it's interesting. Everybody that seems to have made a major screw-up in 9/11 not only wasn't fired, but was promoted. So this was probably the one of the largest screw-ups you could imagine. That's the reason I decided to do this for Foreign Policy magazine, because they was coming out around the time of 9/11, and this is 14 years now, and these questions have never been answered. The key issue here was the fact that for years, not just briefly, but for years, the NSA was eavesdropping on this house in Yemen. It was the key house that bin Laden used as his operations center, since he couldn't conduct operations very easily out of the mountains of Afghanistan. Most of them were conducted in Yemen, and his communications center for Yemen was this house. And that was where a lot of the people that were involved with his operations would meet. So this was a house that the NSA had at the top of their target list. It was Bin Laden's operations center. It was where the operations for the attack on the USS Cole, the attack on the USS embassies, and so forth took place. And it was where the planning for the 9/11 attack was taking place. So on the very day that Bin Laden had one of Bin Laden's affiliates in London had called for the assassination of President Putin, you had a member of the Bin Laden team, one of the hijackers in San Diego, calling to the house the same day. And the NSA claims that not only did it miss that call, it missed all the other calls. He made at least five or six other calls from San Diego to that house. And it seems incredible to anybody involved in technology that this mammoth agency that gets billions and billions and billions of dollars a year can have the most highly sought-after target that it's focused on and not be able to tell where a call is coming from. I mean, this is in the day the days when we have caller ID and when metadata has to precede a phone call, all phone calls, in order for telecom companies to be able to understand how to do the billing, how much to charge and who to charge and so forth. So that's why I decided to interview some of the former senior officials at NSA, and what they told me was that it's impossible, that there was what they call ironclad coverage on that house. In other words, that house was the most highly eavesdropped on house in the world. They had 24-hour coverage on it. And they said it's always essential and it's always possible for the agency to find out where calls are coming from, especially when they've been listening to a house for years. I mean, I think it goes back to 1996. They first started targeting that house with eavesdropping. So, and by now it was 1999 when they first got the indication of 9/11. So that's, again, why I wrote the article, and I was hoping that at some point here the NSA would come up and explain this major discrepancy, why they missed 9/11 and why they're saying they missed it because they didn't have the technical capability to understand where a telephone call was coming from.
And you suggest that 9/11 could have been stopped in its tracks if they had shared this information.
Well, certainly, yeah, because if they found, as soon as the first two hijackers came into the country, and if the NSA had notified the FBI would have begun an immediate program of eavesdropping on their communications, and it would have been totally legal because these people have been identified as associates of Bin Laden. Living in the United States, so it would have been very easy to get a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court warrant, a FISA court warrant, to legally eavesdrop on their communications. And if they had been doing that, they would have picked up all the communications they had in San Diego with the other major players, Mohammed Atta and so forth, on the East Coast. And by listening to those communications and following these people and reading their emails and so forth, they would have certainly been able to see that there was a plot going on and stopped it long before we got to the final stages.
So, Jim, I've talked a few times to Senator Bob Graham, the former chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee at the time of 9/11, and he's also the co-chairman of the Joint Congressional Inquiry into the 9/11 terrorist attacks. And he finds it extraordinary that Midar, the character that we're talking about, who was down in San Diego.
Khalid al-Midar.
Yes, right. Yeah, and his partner, first of all.
Nawaf al-Hazmi.
Right. These two guys were subject of Malaysian intelligence. There was the famous terrorist summit in Malaysia, which Malaysian intelligence monitored. They didn't video, but they audioed. And then the CIA tracked these guys, but they lost them at the airport in Bangkok. And then they show up later in Los Angeles. and they have an extraordinary coincidental meeting at a restaurant with a Saudi intelligence operative who's over here in the United States monitoring Saudi students, and a person from the Saudi consulate in Los Angeles who happened to run into these two guys. They set them up in this house down in San Diego. My understanding is that not just the NSA knew about these people, but also that the CIA did, and the fact the person that did know about them and didn't share that information with the FBI was the person who was the subject of that movie, Zero Dark Thirty, about the killing of bin Laden. So what's going on here? There's just too much smoke around these two guys that you can't deny that there's a huge cover-up going on.
Well, the other irony is the fact that the house they ended up moving in, the house that they ended up getting an apartment in, one of the bedrooms in the house, was owned by a person who was an FBI informant. So there's a lot of coincidences that are taking place here. The key thing, the two, beyond the whatever those documents have to say, which I haven't seen either, and I do hope that they'll come out. But the other major screw-up was the fact that when Khalid al-Midar and Nawaf al-Hazmi went from Yemen, the other one from Pakistan, to Kuala Lumpur, Khalid al-Midar went through Dubai, and the CIA had asked the Dubai government to secretly photograph the passport, and they did. And when they sent it to the Midar was going on his way to Kuala Lumpur, and when they sent the images of the passport to the CIA station and also CIA headquarters, it was extraordinary because the passport contained a fairly recent active visa to the United States, which meant, obviously, these people were coming to the United States. Now, one of the two FBI agents in the in what was known as Alex Station, that was the CIA's bin Laden unit, had been an old friend of mine, Mark Rossini. He was one of the two FBI agents in there, and he's told me numerous times that they wanted very much to send a message to FBI headquarters saying these guys have U.S. visas and they're heading to the United States. And he and his partner drafted a memo to the FBI headquarters telling him this. And then it was denied, they were denied authority to send it by the CIA people in Alex Station. And again, it's never been explained why. Those people have never been reprimanded for not allowing U.S. law enforcement to know that terrorists are heading to the United States. Matter of fact, they were all promoted. So again, this is the biggest event that's happened in probably since World War II, and yet we're not allowed to know why these screw-ups took place or why they're being covered up.
And Alex Station, of course, one of the people at Alex Station was Mike Scheuer, who I've interviewed a number of times, and you have too, James Bamford. He revealed, did he not, that the NSA wouldn't share with the CIA the information that was coming from these wiretaps into this headquarters of bin Laden's operation in Sana'a, Yemen, where all of these 9/11 hijackers were checking in, that the CIA then went ahead and set up their own interception satellite dish, but it apparently only was able to get half of the calls. I'm not sure which half of the calls it got. So walk us through that.
Well, that was another extraordinary thing. When I interviewed Mike Scheuer, again, as you mentioned, he was the head of the of Alex Station, which was a unit at CIA charged with tracking bin Laden. And he knew because NSA told him that they were actively monitoring the house in Yemen, bin Laden's operational center. So he asked NSA for copies of the raw data coming out of the House, not just the weekly summary. And they refused. He asked three times, and each time they refused to allow him to get access to this communication, these communications. So eventually the CIA had to build their own listening post. They built a dish out someplace in the Indian Ocean or someplace in the area where they could catch the satellite beam going down to Sana'a, Yemen. And they were able to pick up parts of the conversation, but they weren't able to pick up the other half. I mean, part of it goes up to a satellite, and unless you have a satellite up there, you're not able to catch a lot of it. So, I mean, it's a very complex thing. That's why NSA has so much technology. So with the limited technology that the CIA had, they were only able to get half the conversations, and then they went back to NSA and asked NSA if they could finally give them the other halves of the conversation so they could make sense of it. And the CIA refused. They constantly refused to do that.
So this, of course, this question arises of whether this was mendacity or incompetence. And, of course, conspiracy theorists have seized on the possibility of mendacity, that somehow the NSA knew about all of this, these plans, and they deliberately kept everybody in the dark for, I guess, to save George W. Bush and Dick Cheney's failing presidency. I mean, that seems to be the assumption in 9/11 truthers conspiracy theories. So what's your sense, though, in terms of mendacity versus incompetence? What would the motive be for not sharing this information? Were they basically waiting to get better information, even though they had pretty damn good information that something was about to happen? Is it a turf battle? What explains?
No, it was turf, basically. Again, I've written about the NSA for decades. I've done three books on the NSA, and I've followed the NSA's history. And in looking at the NSA's history, right from the very beginning, there was always this competition, this jealousy, this sort of animosity between NSA and CIA. Because the NSA has this secret charter when it was created, and it said that only NSA has the power to, or the jurisdiction, however you want to say it, to analyze its own intercepts. Its own, to break the codes and to analyze the information, whatever it intercepts. NSA has the sole, it's what they call the sole executive agent for doing that. So anytime any other agency, not just now, or not just 9/11 rather, but all the time before that, anytime any other agency wanted raw data from NSA, in other words, the raw transcripts, the raw intercepts, as opposed to a summary at some point, they were turned down. And so in the days leading up to 9/11, of course, nobody knew 9/11 was going to happen, the NSA just did what it always did. It says, no, you can't have raw data. I mean, that's our charter. It's in our charter. We're the only ones who have raw data. We issue reports, but we're the only ones that have raw data. So that's sort of the way it worked. It's sort of the way the NSA always operated, and they continued to operate that way in the days leading up to 9/11, and that's why the CIA was always turned down.
Well, but at the time, George Tenet was the DCI, which means Director of Central Intelligence. He's supposed to be a central intelligence. It's not just the CIA. It's all the intelligence agencies. He goes over to Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor, on a number of occasions and keeps saying that bin Laden is determined to attack in the United States. And so did Kofor Black. So they were rattling Condoleezza Rice's cage, and she sort of offhandedly blew them off because the attitude inside the Bush White House was that any warnings coming from the Clintons, which, you know, Clinton passed off all these warnings about bin Laden being a serial killer and determined to come and strike again, they ignored them. It was known as ABC, anything but Clinton. So in that climate, how do you explain the fact that if the DCI is convinced that bin Laden's coming at the United States, why was the NSA not alerted, and why wasn't a high priority put on this information that they already had in-house because they were tapping the headquarters of where the plots were being planned in Yemen.
Well, not only that, I mean, probably one of the biggest ironies in the entire 9/11 is the fact that the hijackers, the ones from San Diego, moved to the East Coast to get prepared to take down the Pentagon, to get the planes to crash into the Pentagon. They were looking for a place to set up their headquarters for the 6 weeks or so before the attack. And the place they decided to set it up was a motel in a town in Maryland called Laurel, Maryland. Well, Laurel, Maryland is the company town for NSA. NSA is the major employer in Laurel, Maryland. So they were only about 2 miles away from NSA headquarters. So you have the NSA headquarters there, which is supposed to be looking for all these terrorists, and you have the hijackers at a motel just a few miles away, and they're going to the same restaurants, the same exercise gyms and so forth. So that's how bad it was. Now, the problem was that NSA feels that it has the authority to turn down any agency that's requesting those documents. I'd seen it numerous times leading up to 9/11. And Tenet, I don't think, just didn't put enough pressure on NSA. From what I understood from Scheuer, Tenet never approached NSA about those documents. Those are questions that should be asked of George Tenet and Condoleezza Rice.
Well, but if Tenet felt that he was alarmed, and apparently so was Kofa Black, thinking that they believed an attack was coming, wouldn't they, as colleagues, him and Hayden, he just even informally said, by the way, Mike, you know, I'm really staying up at night worried about Al-Qaeda attacking us, you know, so you guys better keep a watch out. I mean, what the hell is going on here?
Well, not only that, I mean, he never bothered to presumably he knew about the hijackers coming into the U.S. A year before. Beginning a year before, and because that was it was picked up, you know, like I said, they had as of January 2000, they had indications that these guys were coming because the CIA got copies of the visas. So the CIA had known this since January 2000, and Tenet never bothered to inform the FBI or anybody else about it. So so all these are questions that I, you know, I've always had, and I have no answers to them. I don't speculate because that's somebody else's department. All I do is I'm a reporter, so I report what I find, and it's sure. Sort of an endless circle to get into the whole spend days speculating why people do things. I have no idea. All my job is to report what happens and so forth. I try to avoid being speculating about all these things because it's an endless game.
Well, we can only hope that Senator Graham has been joined by Senator Rand Paul in trying to get these 28 pages declassified from the Joint Congressional Committee report into the 9/11 terrorist attacks, that apparently those who've read them are alarmed by the extent to which they reveal Saudi involvement in 9/11. So I guess stay tuned and keep at it, Jim.
Well, I don't think there should be any. It's like the Kennedy assassination. I don't think there should be any classified documents anywhere, anytime, regarding incidents of that importance. And so, yes, I'm all in favor of Senator Graham on his quest to get those documents revealed, and I'm equally interested in getting NSA to answer those questions I posed in my foreign policy article about why they claimed they didn't know that this was happening, and number two, how they can justify saying that they didn't have the technology to know where a telephone call was coming from.
Well, James Bamford, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian. Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with James Bamford. He's an investigative journalist specializing in national security issues. He was the Washington investigative reporter for ABC World News Tonight and is the author of the best-selling books Body of Secrets, The Puzzle Palace, and The Shadow Factory, Inside the Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to Spying on America. He currently writes for Wired magazine and is also a columnist for Foreign Policy magazine, where he has an article, Missed Calls, Is the NSA Lying About Its Failure to Prevent 9/11? We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with one of America's premier military analysts, William Arkin.
I'm more important in the USA than a spy for the FBI. I'm trained to meet the criminal elite and I seek out wherever evil resides.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is William Arkin, who is a former national security consultant to the New York Times and one of America's premier military experts, having served in Army intelligence in West Berlin during the Cold War. He has written more than a dozen books and been at the center of countless exposés. At the Washington Post, he conceived and co-authored the landmark Top Secret America investigation and co-wrote the national bestseller of the same name. He's also the author of American Coup, and his latest book just out is Unmanned Drones, Data, and the Illusion of Perfect Warfare. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Arkin.
Thank you, Ian. Thanks for having me on.
And I guess what's at stake here is that essentially we're swamping ourselves in data to the point, I mean, we know from 9/11, et cetera, that a lot of the information was there. It was just lost in this haystack where we're looking for needles all the time. But also, you're suggesting not only is our security undermined by the impulse to gather too much data, but that the use of drones to avoid putting our troops in danger has put the rest of us in more danger.
Well, I do say that, Ian, and in my book, I basically have tried to give a bigger survey of the evolution of drones since 9/11, and then specifically to look at not so much the issues that most people focus on, which is targeted killing per se, but the information, the back end of the drone world. And to me, really the revolution that has occurred in the last decade and a half is that we've gone from 200 drones to 11,000 drones, 15,000 if you count all of those that are used by the United States and its allies. We've gone from a situation where there were so few drones flying that everybody could tune in, all the decision makers could tune in and watch actual channels of drones, and even names were used called predator porn or drone crack to describe this kind of mesmerizing picture, to a level now that can hardly even be assimilated by the human eye. And so we've had to disperse the processing, communications, analysis, storage, and retrieval of all of this information into this giant machine. And in many ways, it's made us brilliant, and in many ways, it's made us idiots, because we can do something, and we do it very well. We saw that sort of culminate in 2011 with the death of Osama bin Laden. But since then, as we've killed high-value targets, as they're called, or leaders and lieutenants of ISIS or al-Qaeda or al-Shabaab or whatever organization it might be, we also seem to be stuck in a pattern. We're stuck in a statistical game almost of sort of perfection of doing one thing and an absolute inability to do anything else. So we've created this sort of spying and killing machine that is now meticulous in its ability to find and target an individual, and in that process, we've given over the entire concept of war and of strategy and just war in our sort of achievement of this statistical nirvana.
So when you say in your new book, William Marken, Unmanned Drones, Data, and the Illusion of Perfect Warfare, that we have delegated our moral judgments to machines, what explains the outrage that many people do feel about drones? It does elicit quite a lot of passion. And I'm wondering, in terms of morality, and particularly in the morality of war, if that's not an oxymoron, is it more moral to stick a bayonet in somebody's gut and watch them die than zapping them by a drone?
I don't think it's material one bit. But I think that what's happened as we've become more and more unmanned in the pursuit of our military strategies is that we've lost sight of what a just war would look like if we fought a just war. So not to be too philosophical here, Ian, but let's talk about what war is. War is the last resort. It's what you resort to when you've exhausted all your diplomatic and all your other political possibilities. And what is war? Well, war is something that we have fought under conventions for 6,000 years, and those conventions are that the reason to go to war has to be just, and that the conduct during war has to be just. And what is just? Just is that you conduct yourself during war in such a way that you are able to restore peace. And in the industrial age, we sort of got to the maximum ability to kill, either in grinding industrial warfare of World War I or mechanized warfare of World War II, and then atomic warfare that ended World War II. But in each case, carnage was sort of the victorious element that exhausted states and then forced them to restore the peace. Well, now, you know, like it or not, it's not really material what you think about war. What I've done is done a survey of the war that we've actually fought. And the war that we've actually fought is only really killing I don't know, 200,000, 250,000 people total from 2001 to the present. That's meaning, killed as a result of or in U.S. combat, military and civilian worldwide. And that might have been a bad day in World War II. So you can't look at warfare today in this information age and say, oh, we've become more inhumane. And that's how the military looks at it. They say to themselves, we've become more humane than ever. Hardly anyone is dying compared to the thousands or hundreds of thousands or even millions that died in the industrial wars of our era. And so they don't see anything wrong with what they're doing. In fact, they think we've gotten to a point of precision, which is almost as good as we can do. The President of the United States and other leaders in our country constantly say we're killing without any collateral damage, without any civilians being killed. That's their claim in Pakistan, that no civilians are killed. And so we sort of have gotten to this point now where we are thinking of war in industrial terms. Oh, we have reached this fantastic nirvana of the conduct of war being so different than it was in the industrial age. And yet we are in reality fighting an information war. And that information war that we're fighting is one that is just fundamentally different than the wars of old. And the fact that we can do so with so little impact on our society, no sacrifices, no real involvement of the American people. When I say to most people, Ian, today that, you know, we could be bombing any one of nine countries tomorrow, or that we have bombed any one of nine countries today, and it's not even in the newspapers. So Iraq, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, Somalia, Nigeria, and on. Most people have to like stop for a moment and think, oh yeah, we're fighting a war that is so unremarkable that unless a civilian gets killed, unless there's a controversy, it's almost like an industrial machine, that the only intervention from humans is when an industrial accident occurs. But otherwise, it's just a machine that goes about its business without any human intervention. And I'm not saying that there aren't people making decisions. There are people making decisions. But the decisions that they are making are now so meticulous and so divorced from the objectives of war as we've articulated them for thousands of years, that we don't see that we've basically just become a nation of assassins and a nation of people who are engaged in individual targeted killing with really no connection to what the overall objectives of war might be.
So in terms of perfect warfare, when you mentioned a minute ago, Bill, that the president talks about striking high-value targets without collateral damage. The fact that these drone operators, I believe they're in trailers somewhere outside of Las Vegas, a lot of them are at least, that there have been reports that many of them have suffered from PTSD. Now, the idea that this is a bloodless video game, that defies that idea. And my assumption is that what these drone operators may find disturbing is that the drones loiter over the targets to do after-action target analysis, and perhaps that's when they see the collateral damage of who they've killed.
You know, there's been a lot written about sort of what is the human cost of this new era of unmanned and drone warfare. I'm not sure that I think that it's the trauma of the pilots and the sensor operators that are the issue. It's more that we as a society, so that means, of course, the young men and women who are drawn into the military today, haven't come to grips with the fact that even though everything is the movement of information and is done in a remote way, that it still constitutes killing. I think if people actually want to be in the military and believe that that's an honorable profession, and then they learn themselves what it means to be in the military and what military honor actually entails, then they could be faced with a situation in drone warfare and unmanned warfare where what happens in this remote way begins to challenge their own training and indoctrination. And so in many ways, military people themselves are the ones who are the quickest to say that killing via drone is not honorable and is not the way to go. And there's been a history of Air Force and Navy and other services being passive-aggressive or even anti-drone. And so we should remember that the ability to actually fly a drone, put a weapon on it, and then have that drone identify a target and that drone itself kill the target, so it's sort of in one loop, one person, that capability only began in 2001, and it really only matured in 2006 or 2007, probably with the death of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi in 2006. So this is very new in the annals of warfare. So yes, it's true that we see people beginning to morally question the endeavor, but I think we shouldn't confuse our opposition with war or our moral concerns with war with the fact that war is a constant in our society, and how we conduct ourselves inside that is a really important question that is going to also relate to how we build our future security. How we conduct ourselves in warfare is really essential, and we've been letting the accretion of this machine determine our conduct and determine our future more than anything else. And it's time for us to start to take control of that back and to ask ourselves whether or not we're conducting war in the way in which we as the American people, or in the way in which we believe humanity wants to continue to do this unfortunate but obviously omnipresent activity.
We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment continuing the conversation with William Arkin. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and we're continuing the conversation with William Arkin. Well, who controls the target list, the death list, if you will? My understanding, and I don't know whether you had an opportunity to talk to this person, but apparently he's quite hard to find and quite elusive and and an amazing character. The person who's in charge of the death list, as far as I know, is up in Tyson's Corner, in the Director of National Intelligence. He is a convert to Shia Islam. Very religious guy, never leaves his office, maybe he goes outside occasionally for a smoke, but literally has the death list. Is that correct information?
That's really not correct.
Right.
Well, you've been reading the news media too much, Ian.
That's true. That's why I checked it with you. Yeah.
Yes. So I don't. There really isn't a single a targeting list. I mean, that's kind of the irony of where we are today. There's an Al-Qaeda targeting list. There's a ISIS targeting list. There's an Al-Shabaab targeting list for Somalia. There might be an Al-Qaeda targeting list for Yemen, etc. These are very split efforts. So the day in which we started, like 9/11, with seeing Al-Qaeda as one entity with a hierarchical structure where Osama bin Laden was at the top and then sort of a set of people were in a command structure below, those days don't exist anymore. Now we're talking about a much more decentralized and much more dispersed adversary that we're fighting, and terrorism is not a word, it's not an army. So the selection of individuals also is a matter of tactical significance. So let me explain what that means. If you have a choice in let's say the fight against ISIS of dropping a huge number of bombs on some command installation or some unit of ISIS, we certainly could do that. We have the means to do that. We have the bombers, we have the fighters, we have the ability to do it globally. But if in the process of saying, okay, we want to disable that structure, that function, whatever that function might be, and it might be the person who is giving the commands, and it might be the means by which the commands are being transmitted, then we start to get into the aesthetic of precision. And the aesthetic of precision is, okay, how can we do it with the least amount of expenditure, with the greatest amount of impact? What is the economy of this action? And if it means that we can use one Hellfire missile, 150-pound short-range missile fired from a Predator or a Reaper drone, to kill one individual to achieve a discrete objective, most people in our nation would say, well, that's a better way to do things. But if you're also on a treadmill in which that's all you do, you're just doing that every day, that you're just accumulating the statistics of this new sport that we call unmanned warfare, with no real way to measure advances or success other than, well, we killed the guy, we killed the target, so how can you argue with us that it's success, that it's not success, we killed the target? And I'm arguing that we've become so mesmerized by this process and by the killing, the meticulousness of the effort to identify the individual and then use the least economy, the greatest economy, the least force in order to kill, that we don't even ask ourselves why we're doing it anymore, and whether or not in doing it we're achieving the broader objective that we set up for ourselves, which obviously is to stop terrorism in the United States and then diminish terrorism worldwide. And I don't think that there's a soul on the planet who thinks that we've done that. We've just been basically playing a game of whack-a-mole for 15 years, and we keep being confounded and bewildered by the emergence of new organizations like Al-Shabaab or Al-Qaeda in Yemen or ISIS. And so that's also the cost that we pay, which is to say that we have a magnificent army of IT workers and software specialists who are now able to basically find and identify and kill individuals down to the individual level, it may take a decade, but they can do it, and we certainly couldn't do it before. So we have made an advance, but they also, at the same time, it's such an onerous and time-consuming activity, and so complex that we have lost sight of old-fashioned intelligence, which is to say, what's going on in this country, what's going on in with these people, what's going on with this culture, what's going on in this region, that might inform what we want the ultimate outcome of our military action to be.
Well, clearly these advantages that we have don't last forever, like the monopoly over the atomic bomb. And already we lost a very sophisticated drone over Iran, which I understand was hacked into, and that had some very advanced equipment aboard it. Also, we're not immune from the military-industrial complex, from boondoggling. My understanding is that Northrop's Global Hawk is a flying turkey like the F-35 is.
Well, I think that, again, I'm going to admonish you for a minute here and say that you're applying industrial age thinking to the information age. You know, the Global Hawk drone, as an example, was one of the key elements of the tactical victory in the Iraq War in 2003, when everything else was blinded by the mother of all storms that broke out on the 26th of March in 2003, when the ground forces were halted and the fighter planes could no longer fly, a Global Hawk sitting at 60,000 feet above the clouds with its synthetic aperture radar was able to see through the clouds and detect Iraqi movements. And through satellite-guided bombs, we were able to essentially destroy the Iraqi army that was mobilizing to defend Baghdad. So that's the true story of the war. Now, you can argue that you don't want that expensive a drone, or you don't like drones, or Northrop Grumman, or you can argue all sorts of things about whether or not these weapon systems work or don't work. I'm telling you, Ian, this is a stupid argument, because the way that the world works, all they're going to respond is to say, well, Ian, if you don't like the way that the F-35 isn't good enough, just cut us another check and we'll make it as good as you want it to be. What's your fundamental problem here, that it doesn't work? And so you set up a sort of argumentation in which essentially you're buying into the military strategy and just is saying to the industrial complex or to Washington, just make it economical for me and I'm okay. Make it work and I'm okay. Well, I'm here to say to you, I think these drones do work. That's the problem. It's not that they don't work. It's that they do work. And it's not that we don't have competent people now engaged in this spying and killing apparatus. It is that we do have competent people engaged in this spying and killing apparatus. And so we need to now update our own thinking about what the most effective way is to ensure peace and stability and international security. And I don't think it's arguing anymore industrial arguments about information age problems. Our problem today is too much information, too much of an ability to attack and identify individual targets, and we need to ratchet back our level of activity and consider whether or not this process of meticulous targeted killing is actually achieving the political goal that we want to achieve. If it costs a penny or it costs $1 billion, it's really not material to me if it's not achieving the best for America.
Just yesterday, Bill, I talked to somebody from the Center for Defense Information who looked at this leaked report from the dogfight trials out at Edwards for the F-35, and claiming that the 30-year-old F-16 trainer with drop tanks smoked at 17 out of 17 in a dogfight. So I don't know whether you can contradict that one. You've certainly contradicted what I was told about the Global Hawk.
Well, look, first of all, let me say, we're talking about the secret government and secret world here, and it's not easy to penetrate, and I've been doing this for 40 years. And let me just say that, when I open the book on drones or I open the book on Afghanistan or terrorism or whatever the subject is, I endeavor to find out what the people on the inside actually know and think and what we should as citizens know in order to make intelligent choices. And that's a battle. That's a battle that Washington doesn't want us to know. And so we have to also plow our way through a lot of bad information, a lot of which is introduced by Washington itself, because they would love nothing else than for the American people to discuss how great the F-35 fighter jet should be and not discuss warfare. And so if we get stuck in the debate that they want us to be having, which is, oh my God, this F-35 fighter isn't good enough to beat a 30-year-old F-16, well, then let's make it good enough to beat a 30-year-old F-16. That's exactly the debate that they would love us to be spending our time and energy doing. And all I'm saying to your listeners and to Ian is we have to sometimes rise above what it is that the conventional wisdom and the debate wants us to be.
So since we own all this and we know so little about it, and you've been one of the leading people on the planet who have pried a lot of these secrets loose about what's going on, both with our tax dollars and in our name, do you think that there is any way in the world we'll ever have a rational guns and butter debate?
I remain an optimist about the wisdom of the American people, which is to say that people's intuition generally makes me feel just fine. I spend most of my year in Vermont, Ian, and I often say to people who are of the Washington type, let me put together 10 guys from my little Vermont town, and I bet you we can come up with a better Middle East strategy than your 10 best strategic experts can. So I believe in the American people, and I believe in the intuition of the American people. I don't think that anybody goes home at night and bloodthirstingly says, we've killed another terrorist today by a drone, and therefore I feel safer. In fact, ipso facto, we don't feel safer. The truth of the matter is that we live in a nation and in a society in which we feel more and more unsafe every day. And so there's this kind of strange dynamic at play. I can't say that I don't believe that that the contractors and those who make a profit from the world of the military don't want us to feel unsafe. They do want us to feel unsafe. But also at the same time, they feel unsafe, which is to say that that's their motivation, motivation A, to be engaged in the world of national security. So we're in this kind of crazy bind where we want, on the one hand, to provide all of the support that we can to improve our security, and yet on the other hand, it never seems to improve. And so it's a terrific, what we called in Top Secret America, self-licking ice cream cone. And there is a quality to it of that. But I like to also take one step back and say, okay, well, you know, I've been in this world a long time, and I've seen the arguments made, it's too expensive, there's too much waste, fraud, and abuse, it doesn't work, or whatever those arguments are. And I like to say, you know, maybe we need to really employ some new arguments and some new sort of basic human arguments to this world, because the old arguments don't seem to be having the impact that we want them to have. So technology has become, more and more capable. And we can see that in our own lives today, whether it be the computers we use or the smartphones that we employ all the time. The fact of the matter is that technology has made magnificent advances in the last two decades. And I think we just haven't the ethics of war, and the Magna Carta of our information age just hasn't caught up with the pace of technological change. And so we find ourselves fighting against a set of vague adversaries in a part of the world that even after two decades of war, we still don't evidently understand. And we need to take a step back and ask ourselves what it is we're trying to achieve and what role these magnificent technologies play in achieving that.
Well, one of the things that's odd, though, and apropos this idea of guns and butter, is that the wars that we've been involved in the Middle East, particularly the Bush-Cheney wars, I think most people recognize that they have exposed the limits of military power. We certainly haven't won, you could argue, haven't won a war since World War II. But at the same time, America's soft power seems to be stronger than ever. You know, American movies are more popular in China than anything else, and China's supposed to be our emerging adversary. How do you balance that, soft power versus hard power?
Well, we're not very good at soft power. I mean, that's just a fact of the matter. Let's take the battle for hearts and minds. I mean, have we really changed the view of America or the view of people in the Muslim world since 9/11? I think not. In fact, I would argue that more people hate us today than hated us 15 years ago. So we're not very good at this soft power, and maybe that's one of the prices we pay for our over-reliance on technology and our over-reliance on this sort of data of warfare, if you will. I say the information age as if somehow we have a legion of brilliant tweeters and brilliant propagandists employed by the U.S. government, but the fact of the matter is that what we have is a legion of brilliant software specialists, and they can only do so much if they don't have the content, if you will, to go with it. So, no, clearly we need a balance between soft and hard power, but that balance is never going to occur until we take it seriously that the manifestation of soft power also means that we try to put adequate resources and brain power to the effort.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, William Arkin.
Thanks for having me on, Ian.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with William Arkin, who is a former national security consultant to the New York Times and one of America's premier military experts, having served in Army intelligence in West Berlin during the Cold War. He has written more than a dozen books and been at the center of countless exposés. At the Washington Post, he conceived and co-authored the landmark Top Secret America investigation and co-wrote the national bestseller of the same name. He's also the author of American Coup, and his latest book just out is Unmanned, Drones, Data, and the Illusion of Perfect Warfare. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.